You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect.
So when I was little, meaning younger, still little, there was a family tradition that we had in Delaware, and we would go to this park. It's called Kells Park. I had to look it up this past week because I never knew the name of the park. But this park was right next to the train tracks in Delaware, and we would always go there. And this is a tennis racket because I could not find a racquetball racket. But we would go as kids, my brothers, my two brothers are twins together, and then my parents, and we would go play racquetball, and we would always stop beforehand at the Country Made and get subs, because we called them subs in Delaware, and, you know, there's hoagies and things like that, but they were subs, and not a, what's the other one, the weird grinder, like, come on, what is this, Europe? But we called them subs. We would get subs, and we would go there and play racquetball. I put play in quotes, and we did have racquetball rackets. But mostly we went to watch trains because it was right next to this Amtrak line, which was really, really cool. And I mean, like, right there. There used to be a railroad crossing. Didn't even have a gate. It was just flashing lights. That road is completely blocked off, according to Google Maps now. But I was looking for a racquetball racket to kind of use as my, you know, object lesson as well. And I got a phone call from my mom, and she was like, "Well, we have racquetball rackets." I'm like, "I know you do." And I told her what I'm talking about today, and she was like, "That's really cool. I'm going to London." So she's on a cruise right now to London. Like, okay, fine. But they're in the middle of the Atlantic at this point. But I've got a tennis racket, and I'm telling the story. But one of the things about going to this place, and we love trains growing up, and we actually, this family tradition we have with our own family, is we would get pizza, and we would go to the train station and watch trains. And there's one thing that you need to know, that as people from central Pennsylvania, if you've only lived here, for the most part, your experience, which is really cool, is with diesel trains. And diesel trains are, you know, they're freight trains, I should say, freight trains that are sometimes miles long. And if you're looking for stories, I don't know where Jen is. Danny Bollinger can tell you stories about trains. We would always pump him for a prime group, like, tell us more cool stories. But Danny worked on trains. But the diesel train, it's usually got like 2-3 engines. And again, some of these are almost miles long with all the freight that they're carrying. And when a diesel train is coming, I mean, it's like 15 minutes out, and you can hear the and, you know, and it's slowly, you can kind of feel the shaking, and then eventually, you know, the train kind of comes through here in our area, and so you know it's coming. In Delaware, we were part of what is called the Northeast Corridor for Amtrak, which is basically this route between Washington, D.C. and Boston. And in between Washington, D.C., the major cities were Baltimore and then Baltimore, Maryland, and Wilmington, Delaware, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, you know where that is, and then New York City and then Boston. There were other stops along the way. But it was a commuter line, a fast line, that would have multiple trains per hour. Like, we get Amtrak, is it still two times a day? I know they were talking about four, but I haven't seen the second one. So we get Amtrak two times a day, and it's a diesel engine that comes through on Amtrak. And so these were Amtrak trains with, instead of, you know, hundreds of cars, you're looking at 10, 8 cars, and they would come through multiple times an hour. And on that Northeast Corridor, there was no diesel engines because it was all electric. They had all the high power lines and those little things that would push up against it, and the train would go by. And so if we were to watch a train, and again, we could see lots of them, Amtrak trains, and they would go flying by. They would go flying by. And so in order to watch the train, we needed to listen for the railroad crossing, for the crossing bells to go ding, 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 ding. Because if you were just listening for the train, literally seconds before the train showed up, you'd hear, you hear this like sizzle sound, and then it goes, and then the train is gone. Like, that's how fast the trains were. And so if you were waiting to hear for the train, by the time you heard it, you'd be hit. You'd be dead. And so, you know, again, around here, you can like, oh, yeah, it's coming. It's coming. All right, kids, it's coming. It'll be here eventually. Yeah, it's I know, it's I can hear it, you know, it's coming. But in Delaware along this line, it was just that, it was that sizzle sound. It was like, and then the train was gone. And the whole thing is that if you had waited, you know, if you used your, and I'm not trying to, I don't know, this is weird, like I'm tearing you down because of your way you listen to trains, that's strange. But if you used your Central Pennsylvania train ears in Delaware, you'd be dead because you can't rely on your sense of hearing, because your sense of hearing would throw you off. And today we're going to talk about a story as we wrap up the census series. And I know it's 4 weeks, but we have five senses. Sorry, you're going to have to come back for new sensations with your prime group next week to hit all five of them. But we're looking at the sense of hearing. And we're looking at this passage in the Bible. And sometimes if we just rely on our sense of hearing, or just, again, the idea of experience and what we can sense and feel and hear, we can actually miss what God is about to do. Again, if you were just listening for the sound of trains in Delaware, it'd be too late. You'd miss it. And sometimes we rely on our sense of hearing or just our experience, and we think, okay, according to my experience, according to what I can hear, this is what I know about God, and specifically about some of the promises God has made for us. Because a lot of times we're like, okay, you know, yeah, okay, according to my time, the promise, you know, God should have come through. According to my timetable, he should have answered. According to my timetable, this should have happened. And again, if you're coming to Delaware, to Kells Park, and you're waiting for the trains to come by, if you're listening for that, like, okay, I haven't even heard the sound. There clearly are no trains. In seconds, the trains are coming by. And so kind of the same idea is we're like, according to our timetable, God doesn't seem to work, or maybe God doesn't want to, or maybe God doesn't care. And we have all these ideas, and if we're just relying on our sense of hearing, as we see in today's point, it can miss what God is about to do. And according to our senses, God seems like he fails to come through. But he always comes through on his promises exactly at the right time. So we're going to look at a passage here in the book of 1 Kings, and we'll turn on the house lights if you have a paper Bible. 1 Kings was part of one of the, well, technically four books, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, that we studied during the King Me series this past summer. And actually, we're looking at the King Ahab, and we'll talk about why he was a bad guy. But the week we talked about Ahab was called Flame Out, and you can find that was actually a video we watched this past summer where we talked more specifically about Ahab. And if you remember from the King Me series, at this point, and we're going to look at a different king a little bit later today, but at this point, by the time Ahab is king, the nation of Israel had split into two kingdoms. There's the northern kingdom of Israel, and then the southern kingdom of Judah. And the northern kingdom had all bad kings. The southern kingdom of Judah had some good kings and some bad kings. And eventually, the northern kingdom was assimilated by Assyria, where they were scattered among the people. And then the southern kingdom, eventually Babylon came and brought them back to their land as a punishment. And we're not getting to that. But so we're looking at this northern king of Israel, this King Ahab. And he was not a good king. And so I want to just kind of give you a quick setup, some background to what the rest of the story is, because Ahab aroused anger. Ahab arouses God's anger. And in 1 Kings chapter 16, and we're going to jump from 16 to 17 to 18. So if you have YouVersion, you can just tap over on the next one when we get there. But he was a bad king. He was a bad, I don't mean bad like not a good one in terms of he failed to lead well, which he did. But he was a very wicked king. And he did not honor God. And specifically in 1 Kings 16, verse 32, this was kind of the beginning of the middle of this chapter said, you know, Ahab has come into power now. He's the new king of Israel. And just describing what Ahab did was that first Ahab built a temple and an altar for Baal or Baal. You know, if we're fancy, we can say Baal. And sounds people like, are you okay? Do you need like the Heimlich? Actually, if you were making sounds, you don't need the Heimlich, because when you're choking, you can't actually make sounds. So that's a true fact for you to know. Anyway, but an altar for Baal, an altar for Baal in Samaria, which was the capital of the northern kingdom. And it says, then he set up an Asherah pole, which was a pole, which is another way to worship this goddess Asherah. And I'll talk about them in just a second. And he did more, it says, he did more to provoke the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than any other kings of Israel before him. So they were supposed to worship the true and the living God, Yahweh. They were supposed to worship God and worship him in his temple and sacrifice to him. But Ahab comes into power and he's like, hey, you know what we're going to do? We're going to build a temple and an altar for this false god, Baal. And we're going to set up a pole, an Asherah pole, to worship this goddess, Asherah. And the interesting thing about these two, and this is what's going to matter in a moment, is Baal, or Baal, I might say Baal, he was considered to be the god of rainstorms. He was the god of rainstorms. And so they would, like, when you, and if you think about it from there, you know, a long time ago, what are we looking at? 4,000 years ago, not understanding electricity and magnetism and particles and charging and all that. And a rainstorm would be pretty scary. And so they looked at it and said, okay, Baal, you know what I'm saying, that he was this like intense god. So he was the god, lowercase g, of rainstorms. He was the god of storms, of thunder and rain. And that's what they worship, because like, wow, there's some serious power there. And the Asherah, was that Shira, the princess of power? Anyway, He-Man. Anyway, Asherah, she was considered the goddess of fertility. And so she was worshipped because she brought forth crops and she brought forth children. And so if you didn't have, you know, if your livestock, if you didn't have enough livestock, you would pray if you were a pagan person or Ahab or the people of Israel at the time, you would pray to Asherah and pray that she would produce the crops for your ground, or she would, you know, your bulls wouldn't have babies. Cows have babies. I know this because I am so amazing. I think, right? Is that right? But not steer. Steers don't have anything, literally. Anyway, so that's what they would do. And so this Baal or Baal was this god of rainstorms, and Asherah was the god of fertility. Okay, that's important to know. But the biggest thing is that Ahab was a bad king. And he was not honoring God. And he taught the people. He's like, I'm your leader. And so you're going to follow me and worship these pagan gods. So that's kind of just the setup for what's happening with Ahab arousing anger there. But now we're going to see some promises that God makes. And you're going to see how the sense of hearing kind of comes into play in a little bit with this. But really the idea, again, with this whole series, isn't about hearing, taste, smell, touch. It's about, are we allowing our experiences to determine what we know about God and what we understand about him and his promises and who he is and his perspective and all of that? So the first thing we see is a promise that sounds absurd. And that promise was a promise for drought. And so jumping to chapter 17 now, we meet this guy, Elijah. And this is the first time, if you've heard of Elijah the prophet, this is the first time we meet him in the Bible. And it says in 1 Kings 17:1, now Elijah, who was from Tishbe in Gilead, told King Ahab. So he went to the king. And as we've said so many times before, a prophet simply was a spokesperson for God. They would speak on behalf of God to the people. And Moses was considered a prophet as well. And so they would speak on behalf of God to the people. And so he goes to Ahab and says, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, the God I serve, just as a note there, Ahab, you're not serving him. He says, as surely as the Lord lives, there will be no dew or rain during the next few years until I give the word. And so Elijah says, God has made this promise that for the next few years, there won't be any dew or rain. And it sounds kind of like an absurd promise, because if you're Ahab, you're going like, you know what? I don't really care about the God you serve, the God of Israel, because I've got Baal and he's the God of rainstorms, and I've got Asherah. She's the princess. No, she's the God of fertility. He's like, I don't need your God. This is stupid. Okay, fine. Your God is going to do that. And it sounds kind of dumb. And so Ahab, as we'll see in a little bit, doesn't really believe. But God was here, if you haven't picked up on it already. God was making a statement about who the true God is. Oh, so your God is the God of rainstorms? You're not going to have rain. Oh, your God is the God of fertility? Then your crops will not have water. And so I am going to make this promise. And he was very specifically targeting who Ahab had set up to worship. You with me on that? Does that make sense? He set up these pagan gods, and God's like, oh, I'm going to show you who's really in control here. And so it seemed absurd to Ahab. It doesn't make any sense. And so I just, before we kind of get into more of the story, I want to ask you the question. Like, are there promises maybe that God has made to us, to his people, to his church, to his followers, that maybe seem a little absurd, maybe seem a little ridiculous, seem a little cray-cray? Because just because our experience says, no, that doesn't make sense. We don't need this drought. That's not going to happen because I've got Baal and Asherah. But sometimes there are things that God has promised, and we're like, no, that doesn't make sense. And before we just go, nah, no, that can't be true, maybe we need to hold back and say, can we trust God's promises? Can we experience it? Are experiences the only way that we can know who God is? Or do we trust that if he's made a promise, he is going to keep it, that he is going to come through? And so you've got this promise that sounds absurd, specifically because Elijah is speaking to Ahab. But then we've got God comes through for certain. So just to clarify, you know, Ahab's like, yeah, that's dumb, whatever. Okay, fine. But God just shows up and says, no, this sounds weird to you. It sounds ridiculous to you, but I am the true and living God, and I'm coming through. You don't think I can, but watch what happens. And so we have that in the second, or in later in chapter 17 of 1 Kings. There's a couple of passages here. First of all, in verse 7, it says, after a while, this is Elijah was sent to live by a brook, and ravens fed him and brought him meat. It was kind of wild. You can read about that in 1 Kings 17. But he's by this brook, and it's a stream, a creek, if you will. I would say a creek. You might say a creek. But he's by a body of water, and it is so droughty. Is that a word? It is now. It is so droughty that the brook dried up. So, like, imagine the Kish just drying up. Like, it's that dry. And said a little bit later, we find out in chapter 18, it says that, meanwhile, the famine had become very severe in Samaria, which is the capital of Israel, of the northern kingdom of Israel. So all these little hints about, like, it is so bad that there was a severe famine. Why is there a famine? Because there's no rain, and there's no rain, so there's no crops. And there's no crops, there's nothing to eat, so that's pretty bad. And that's severe. And so there is no rainfall or storms, and there is no fertility. And then, just as an interesting note, Jesus references Elijah. And in Luke chapter 4, it says, in Elijah's time, when the heavens were closed for 3.5 years, and a severe famine devastated the land. And so there was this serious, serious famine, and a lack of rain for 3.5 years. And that's a long time. Like, no rain. Do you understand this? And I'll talk about this in a second. But no rain. Not, like, in our context, we're kind of like, it's a drought. Why? Because instead of the normal 10 inches we would get in the span of this month, we got 3. Their situation is, instead of the normal 10 inches, we got 0. And then the next month, 0. The next month, 0. So that's pretty devastating. That's pretty devastating to what's going on here. So God came through. Even though they're like, no, I got my gods. God's like, I'm going to show you who your gods are and how you can't count on them, because I'm going to stop them dead. I'm going to stop the whole thing. And so God came through, even though it seemed absurd. And that's the question for you to think about. Is that, again, is there something you're like, that doesn't seem like, why would God care about me? Why would God do that? That doesn't matter. That's not a big deal. Or how could he do that? If God's made the promise, he will come through for certain. He will come through. He always comes through. So that was one promise that we see here, was this promise that seemed absurd. And then you've got another promise that sounds delayed. It sounds like, okay, this is not happening on my timetable. This is not happening when I think it should happen. And so there's this delayed promise there that we see of rain in 1 Kings 18. And this is what it says. Later on, in the third year of the drought, 3 years of drought, the Lord said to Elijah, go and present yourself to King Ahab. So now he's 3 years later, going back to the King Ahab, and says, tell him that I will soon send rain. So Elijah went to appear before Ahab. And so he says, you need to go before Ahab and tell him this. And then once you do that, because he's not near him, he has to travel there. And at this point, Elijah, people don't like Elijah because he's kind of a troublemaker. He's trying to direct people back to God rather than worshiping their idols. And he says, you need to go before Ahab. And when you go before him, tell him that I'm going to soon send rain. And again, that kind of sounds a little delayed. And 3.5 years is what we just saw in Luke. Jesus said it ended up being 3.5 years when all was said and done. There was you're probably familiar with the Dust Bowl in the United States back in the 1930s. And there was a drought, and there was a whole lot more tied to the drought that happened back then. Poor use of land and all of that. And so that was about a 10-year period, but it was way, way more than just simply a drought. But in the United States, in the modern history of the United States, from 1988 to 1990, there was a 2 to 2.5 year drought that is considered the costliest drought in the history of the country. And it's almost as equivalent as the cost of Hurricane Katrina in terms of natural decimation to our country. And it was a time of, like I said, about 2 years without a lot of rain, not with no rain, but without a lot of rain. And they said that $60 billion worth of loss that happened because of this drought. And in modern day, I think they said it was something like $150 billion adjusted for inflation from two-ish years of not as much rain. So just perspective. So the biggest drought the biggest financial disaster as far as drought in United States history, and also comparative to like Hurricane Katrina, the damage from hurricanes, this was pretty significant. And it was 2 years, and it was less rain. We're talking 3.5 years of no rain. So this is devastating. And if God is saying, hey, I'm going to send rain, at that point, if you're 3 years into this deal, you're probably like, whatever. Too little, too late. Why would God come through now? The damage is already done. Things have already fallen apart. Like, why do I care? And that's why it would seem like, well, God didn't come through on at the right time. God didn't come through when he was supposed to. God just, he made this promise. It was delayed. God, I don't really care about your promise now because I wanted it 3 years ago. Or at least maybe 2 years ago. We'll get a year of drought. That kind of sucks, but you know. But God, where have you been? Like, I don't care about your promise now. And how often do we feel the same way? Like, God, this is when I needed this. And you didn't give me what I needed when I needed it. So you're not even, why can I count on you? You didn't come through on my timetable. Your promise, it was delayed. Like, what good is a late promise? And you guys know how that is. Missing something because it's late. You show up late somewhere. There's certain moments where, like, you know, I remember I've done many weddings over the years, and I've watched important family members show up at a wedding as we're watching them walk back down the aisle. Like, the ceremony's over. Like, oh, they were caught in traffic or whatever. And like, oh man, you kind of missed the big part. And yet we look and say, you know, being late is not really helpful. And so to Elijah, to the people, it was kind of like, God, thanks for your promise, but you're late. We needed you earlier. Why didn't you come through when we needed you? And again, do we look at things and say, God, this is when I needed you and you didn't come through? But maybe it's not because God's late, but because God has a perfect time for things. And so we see that the next thing with this promise is that God came through on time. And see, for the people, it was late, and wow, we needed more of this. But before we go into the passage here, I want to give you what happens when Elijah goes to Ahab and says there's going to be no rain. He actually meets Ahab, and he meets the prophets of Baal. He meets the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, which is the mount in Old Testament Israel area. Caramel is the sauce that you put on your ice cream. Not caramel. Caramel is a mountain. Caramel is what we put on ice cream. They're not hoagies. They're subs. They're not subs. Or they're subs, not grinders. Whatever. Tomato, 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 tomato. Anyway, But he goes to the top of this mountain and he says, I want you, he says to Ahab, look, God has sent me to you and said there's going to be rain, but I need you to gather all the prophets of Baal and we're going to come together and we're going to have a little Baal worship fest. We're going to have this amazing festival of worshiping Baal. And he said, what we're going to do and by the way, I'd like to worship God too, but we'll let Baal go first. And so he brings all these prophets, and there's like about 138, 140, 150 of them there. They all come together and Elijah says, here's how we're going to do it. Just because God wants to say something, he wants to provide rain, he wants to show up a little bit. He says, I want you, prophets of Baal, to build an altar to Baal. And you're going to put all the, cut up the meat, set it all on the altar. And then you guys pray to Baal and ask him to like zap and consume and send fire to burn up this offering. Because, you know, an offering is meant to be burnt. It's a burnt offering. That's why it's called that. So that's what you're going to do. And they're like, yeah, sounds good. Baal's going to come through for us. I mean, Elijah's like, you mean like he did with the rain over the last 3 years? Okay. And so they all get there together. They make this altar and they build it. And then they say, Elijah's like, guys, go ahead and pray. And so they're like, okay, pray. And they're like, Baal, come through, you know, bring us fire. And they pray and they start in the morning. And by midday, Elijah, he's awesome. He's like, guys, maybe he's asleep. He's probably just asleep. So just pray louder. Just pray louder, and maybe that'll wake him up. He's probably asleep. Sorry, that's why nothing's happening. And so they pray louder, and then it says they start cutting themselves and slashing themselves. Their blood is pouring out to show their dedication to Baal. And it goes on all day, and nothing happens. And so, okay, Baal isn't looking too powerful on multiple levels right now. So Elijah says, now it's my turn. And so he sets up an altar, and he actually makes it because Ahab had actually torn down the altars to the true and living God. He sets up this altar and he puts 12 stones in it because the 12 stones represent the 12 tribes of Israel. And sets up this altar, puts the, and before he puts the meat on it, he actually digs a trough around the edges. And so there's this trough all around the edges of this altar. And he sets the meat up on the altar and he says, oh, hey, guys, can you, why don't you just, you know, I know I'm going to call for God to consume this offering here, but would you go get a bucket of water? Just, you know, pour the bucket of water. Now, it's during a drought, so that's kind of a big request. They pour a bucket of water over the altar. And he's like, oh, why don't you guys do that again? They're like, it's going to be a hard time for God to burn up your altar or your offering if it's covered in water. He's like, yeah, just get another one and get another one. And eventually they get so much water that this trough around the altar fills with water. And then Elijah says, and now I'm going to pray to God. And he basically just prays, you know, God, show them that you're the true and living God. And boom, fire comes down from heaven, not only burns the offering that's there, completely consuming it in an instant, but all of the water on the offering and all of the water in the trough. It is an instant consuming of this offering. And so all the people are there watching the prophets of Baal fail, and then, so that works better, Baal fail, and then God comes through in an instant. And so Elijah says, guys, it's time to get right with God. And so he tells the Israelites, you need to kill these prophets of Baal, these people that are worshiping this pagan god. And so they do. And you're like, why would God kill them? We talked about that in Crop 2. You can find that online. But they were all killed. And so at this point, Baal worship is not just figuratively, but literally dead. And God was trying to make a statement. And so all the prophets are now dead. And then in verse 41 of chapter 18, it says, then Elijah says to Ahab, telling the king, get something to eat and drink, for I hear a mighty rainstorm coming. And if you're Ahab, and again, understanding the context here, that's not possible because the God of the rainstorms, like all his guys are dead and he didn't really show up for us on the altar. And that's because God was making a statement and it was on purpose, on time, for God just to show them that, oh, I'm not late. I need all of Israel to recognize that this isn't like, well, that could have been Baal. No, no. This was clearly the true and living God. And so Ahab went to eat and drink, but Elijah climbed to the top of Mount Carmel and bowed low to the ground and prayed with his face between his knees. And he begins praying. And he's not praying because, like, God, I hope you come through. He's praying because he says, God, I know you're going to come through. I believe that you've made this promise. You said when I would go before Ahab, you would bring a rainstorm. And it affects him as well. It's not just Ahab. It's him. And he says to his servant, go and look out toward the sea. And rainstorms would typically come across the Mediterranean Sea there. And so he went and looked, and he returned to Elijah and said, I don't see anything. And don't even go to the next slide. He says, go and look, I hear the rain coming. And if you're, you or me, I'm like, oh, I had my shot, God didn't come through, fine. I'll go back and worshiping, bow. I'll go back and find my own way to solve this problem. Because I prayed and God didn't come through. But God promised. And so Elijah didn't stop praying. And Elijah didn't give up on God. And it says that 7 times Elijah told him to go and look. Finally, the 7th time, his servant told him, I saw a little cloud about the size of a man's hand rising from the sea. And, you know, maybe he's optimistic. Maybe he's like, oh, that'll be it. Oh, there we go. God came through, huh? Huh? I got a little wet there, a little some here. I think you spit on me. No. I think that was rain. But his faith was so great, Elijah says, hurry to Ahab and tell him, climb into your chariot and go back home. Because if you don't hurry, the rain will stop you. Why? Because if you're riding a chariot that has wheels through a dry area and rain comes, it's going to create mud, right, and you're not going to get anywhere. And so Elijah's faith is so strong in God's promise that he's like, don't tell him to get out of here. And he's like, but it's just a little hand. That's not going to stop his chariot. But it says, and soon the sky was black with clouds. Soon the sky had a rainstorm. Soon the God of the rainstorm, who is really the God of the rainstorm, showed up. And a heavy wind brought a terrific rainstorm. And Ahab left quickly for Jezreel. And it's really kind of cool, and we don't have time to get into this. But he goes back, and by the way, he's married to Jezebel. There's a reason people talk about Jezebel, like bad thing. Like, yeah, she's bad. She's bad news. And he actually God kind of turns his heart a little bit, and he goes to Jezebel, and like, well, let me tell you. God might be the real and living God. She's like, no, you're wrong. And trouble ensues from that point on. But God was showing up, and it seemed, if you were Elijah, if you were the servant, it seems like, I don't know, you're late. But if God came through earlier, if the rain happened earlier, you do realize that this event at Mount Carmel and the rainstorm changed the hearts of the nation back to God. But if the rainstorm had happened earlier, before this moment, they'd have been like, all right, we've been praying to Baal and he came through. But it was right on time so that the people recognized, no, this wasn't our God, lowercase g, of rainstorms. This wasn't our goddess of fertility, because both of them have been shown that they can't do squat. But the true and living God came through right on time. And we can count on his promises. And it might seem like it's late to us. It might seem like it's, well, I needed this now. But God says, no, I want this in a moment, because now isn't when the best time is for you, because I love you and I care about you. And so we need to remember that and reflect on the fact that God comes through exactly on time. And again, going to the senses idea that our sense of hearing, that if we just count on, if we're like the servant going, I don't hear anything, I don't see anything. If we're just counting on what we can experience, go, it doesn't feel like God's coming through. And it didn't feel like God was coming through for 3.5 years. But God still had a plan. And God did come through exactly when it matters. And our sense of hearing can miss what God is about to do. And if we just allow our experience to dictate and determine how we trust God, how we follow God, how we obey God, we're going to miss. And if you're counting on what you experience on, oh, I know when a train is coming because I'll hear the rumble and it'll take about 10 minutes before it gets here. And if you go to Delaware and try to rely on that sense, you're going to be hit by a train. You probably won't get hit. It'll be more like a splat. They go very fast. And it's the same thing. It's that we can't just rely on our senses to say, this is what I know. And so if all I can experience is this, then that's what I know about God. And you know, that's what this is all about. This whole series is saying, Are we just saying, oh, if I can touch it, then it's good? If I can smell, I mean, we talked about that a couple weeks ago. Like, how does that tie into it? You can listen to that if you weren't here. If I can't see it, and we miss God's bigger perspective. Like, there's just so many things that we're human, and God's not. God's God. And that's where we trust Him. That's where faith comes in. Say, God, yeah, you do have a bigger perspective. And you care about every little detail, even whether these guys' clothes smelled like smoke. And God, if I just, instead of just trying to trust what I can touch or experience, maybe I just need to say, God, can you give me wisdom? And again, maybe we just miss because we're like, oh, my experience says that God's late or God's not going to come through. But maybe we need to say, no, I'm not going to trust my experience. I'm going to trust God. And so to kind of wrap up this week and the series a little bit, I want to talk about what happens even when it doesn't make sense. And, you know, what does it look like to actually, or let me back up. What are the problems? What are the dangers if we just rely on our senses? And again, our senses include what we can experience, but a lot of times our brain gets caught up in that sometimes too. Like, well, on paper, this doesn't make sense. On paper, I shouldn't give this much money because if I give this much money, then, you know, my checking account, my bank account says it won't work. But if you say, okay, God's the one in control and provides for all of your needs, maybe He will come through. So sense sometimes ties into that. But what I want to reference, that's three things, not four. Three things, but when we rely on our senses instead of believing God, when we rely on our senses instead of believing God, it can lead to a couple of things, three things specifically. And not always, but if we're just like, I'm going to go based on what I can experience, based on what I know, based on how I see the situation, based on how I feel. And if we do that, instead of actually believing, no, God says this, I'm going to believe it. God told me to do this, I'm going to do it. God told me to trust Him, and I will trust Him. God promised this to me, and I'm going to believe that He will come through. And so there's a couple of things. The first thing that relying on our senses instead of believing God is that it can lead to manipulation. And when we talk about manipulation here, we're looking at, oh, I need to get ahead, catch up on my notes. We're going to look at the story of Abraham a little bit. And Abraham didn't believe, I have a lot of notes. There we go. Abraham got to a spot where he's like, God made this promise, but you know what? It doesn't seem like He's coming through, so it's my job to step in. It's my job to step in and fix it, to solve it, as Carla prayed, to take control. It's my job to do that. And that's the problem when we start relying on our senses and say, okay, according to my timeline, according to what I know, according to what I experience, this isn't working, so I need to manipulate the situation, which is a problem. And so we're looking at different chapters here in Genesis, and we're going to get different chapters in some of the other books here. But in Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, just to set you up for some context, you're probably aware of this story, you're probably aware of it on some level. But in Genesis 12, 1, by the way, these three things, the manipulation and the other two things we're talking about, I actually pulled them directly from the I God series that I taught like a million years ago. I think it was 12 years ago, 10 years ago, something like that, when I taught about God's promises. So this is my content, but not necessarily new content. But in Genesis chapter 12, it says, the Lord had said to Abram, by the way, later his name gets changed to Abraham, so it's the same guy. The Lord said to Abram, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. He says, you know, he calls Abram and said, I'm about to make something big out of you. He says, I'm going to make you into a great nation. Now, in our context, that means like, oh, he's going to have lots of territory. But this really wasn't about the size of the land or where the borders were on the map. This was the size of his family, that you will become a nation. That would be like any of you, just, you know, picking your last name, saying, there is going to be the nation of Fitch, of all the Fitches that rule the world, or something like that. Like, that's what's going on here. Like, when God says, I'm going to make you into a great nation, he's talking about he is going to have many, many, many descendants. And he says, I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And then he says that all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. And if you take a moment, and this is not in the notes, but if you look at the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew, and there's one in Luke, and I forget which one goes all the way back to Abraham, check them both out. But Jesus' lineage is traced all the way back to Abraham. And Jesus is the one that blessed the entire world through Abraham. But sorry, spoiler, Abraham has kids. But he says, I'm going to make you into a great nation. You're going to have lots and lots and lots and lots of kids and grandkids and great-grandkids and great-great-grandkids and great-great-great-great-great-great-grandkids and all of that. And so it says, so Abram went as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. This is brother, cousin. Brother, cousin? His relative Lot. He's related to Lot. It's lots of them. No. So he went with him. He didn't have any kids. And so Abram was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. So this all happened, Abram's 75. Now, I'm not going to ask anybody to raise their hand, but if you are 75 or older, do you expect to be having children anytime soon? I'm not going to ask anyone to raise your hand, but if you're 50 years or older, are you expecting to have children anytime soon? We could even back it up to, say, 40. Now, there's people that have kids after 40, but it's not very common. 75, and God says, I'm going to give you so many descendants and so many children and grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren that it is going to be insane. It's going to be a great nation. He was 75 years old. So, that's the promise God made. Now, time passes. It's about 10 years later. Now Abraham's 85 years old. Still no kids. But God made this promise. And so Abram's going, okay, God made this promise. I'm getting really old. I'm probably not going to be able to have kids. By the way, my wife, she's pretty old too. And, we're just old. And so he's like, okay, now if God made this promise, so it's my job now to come through. It's my job to manipulate the situation and make it work. And so we pick up here in Genesis 16. It says, now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. So still, no kids. But she had an Egyptian slave named Hagar. So she said to Abram, the Lord has kept me from having children. Kind of blaming God, but we won't get into that right now. So she says, go, sleep with my slave. Perhaps I can build a family through her. She's like, we haven't had kids. God made this promise. Why don't you just sleep with my slave? That seems appropriate. So many levels of questions there. And then Abram was like, my dear wife, how would we dishonor the Lord in such a way? It shall never be. No. He says, Abram agreed what Sarai said. So after Abram had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarai's wife took her Egyptian slave Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. And he slept with Hagar and she conceived. And then it says, Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael. So he has the kid. Okay, now this is the answer. Nope. Abram, you disobeyed God and you manipulated the situation because you didn't trust him. And we get into those spots where he's like, okay, according to what I can experience, according to my senses, I'm old and I ain't getting any older and somebody needs to do something about this. And so enter Hagar and Ishmael. And there's a bunch of tension between Isaac and Ishmael. Oops, spoiler. For the rest of history. But then, so that was Abram disobeying God, saying, I need to manipulate the situation. And then time passes, and it says, now the Lord was gracious to Sarah, her name was changed, as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah what he had promised. Sarah became pregnant and bore a son to Abraham in his old age. At when? Too late? Oh, I'm sorry, Abraham, I totally forgot. No. At the very time God had promised him, Abraham gave him the name Isaac, to the son Sarah born him. When his son Isaac was 8 days old, Abraham circumcised him as God commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Many of us are going, I don't think I'm going to be alive at 100 years old, much less having kids. And Abraham had the easy part. Sarah had a baby, very, very old. But the point was, Abraham and Sarah were both looking into their own experience and saying, God made this promise, and if he didn't come through when I thought he should, so therefore we need to manipulate the situation. And again, it caused all sorts of tension between Ishmael and Isaac, throughout history. So that's one of the situations. If we rely on our senses instead of believing God, it can lead to manipulation, and we feel like we have to fix the situation. And the question is to you, do you do that? Do you end up resorting to manipulation? Is God's promise so out there that you believe it's up to you to fix it? Is there something that God has promised and you're like, oh, that's not how I think it's going to work. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make God come through. Manipulate the situation. Disobey God. And I just want to say, God comes through always when he promises. Even if it doesn't make sense, even if our experiences, our timetables say this isn't right, God is exactly always on time and can do and will do what he has promised. The second thing that our senses can do, if we rely on our senses instead of believing God, is that it can lead to justification. We can do something wrong and go like, but that's okay because I'm working on the promise God made. I'm going to sin. I'm going to disobey God, sort of like Abraham. I'm going to do something wrong, but that's cool because it's all part of God's plan. I'm going to sin, but it's all right because it's a promise and I'm working through it. And we did a whole series called After God where we talked about this story amongst other things. You can find that on the slide afterwards. But we're looking at the life of King David. Now, David was the second king of Israel. Spoiler again. But this is a united Israel. They weren't split into two yet. So it was one nation, one kingdom of Israel. And in 1 Samuel 16, Jesse, God is tired of Saul. By the way, Amazon Prime has a so far pretty good show called The House of David that's quoting the Bible and talking about the story of David. If you have a chance to check it, so far I'm not going to vouch for the whole thing yet, but so far I'm like, okay, it's pretty biblical. There's other shows I can say do not watch them because they are not biblical. Noah, don't ever. No. But anyway, so God is tired of Saul and and he's like, he has not obeyed me. And so he says to Jesse, who is a judge, says to Samuel to go to Jesse, and you're going to anoint a son of Jesse as the next king of Israel. You're going to pick the next king. And so, of course, all the sons come before Samuel, and we talked about this just a few weeks ago. And he says to Jesse, the biggest ones were there, the tallest, strongest ones, but the youngest one wasn't there. He says, are all the sons you have? These are all the sons you have? They're still the youngest, Jesse answered. He's tending the sheep. And so Samuel said, send for him. We will not sit down until he arrives. So he sent for David and had him brought in. He was glowing with health and had a fine appearance and handsome features. Then the Lord said, rise to Samuel, rise and anoint him. This is the one. So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. So God chose David and said, David is going to be the next king of Israel. God has decreed that David will be the next king. But Saul is still alive. Saul is still alive and kinging. And he is still there on the throne. And so, by the way, it's against the law, the Jewish law, to kill the king. It's frowned upon. So that's context. So he's going to be a king. God has promised. So lots of time passes. David does this thing. He kills this tall guy. Everybody's like, David, that was awesome. We love you so much. Saul gets jealous because David killed the tall guy. And eventually, David has to flee for his life. And he has some guys that come with him, his band of brothers, and they end up running from Saul. And Saul is like sending armies trying to catch David. And so he gets to this spot where they end up hiding in these caves in En Gedi. Chapter 24, it says, after Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, David's in the desert of En Gedi. So Saul's like, okay, I want to get this guy because I don't like him. And so Saul took 3,000 able young men from all of Israel and set out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. That's a great place. The crags of the wild goats. Yeehaw! He came to the sheep pens along the way. A cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. So, Saul was doing, his thing. And just for the record, without getting too graphic, they all had robes. So, let me just say this. Urinals didn't exist in biblical times because of the robes. It would be very, very messy. So everybody squatted. Okay? You with me? You had to gird up your loins and squat. And so Saul goes into this cave, and to relieve himself. So he's squatting. And it says David and his men were far back in the cave. So like, what are the odds that he goes into the same cave of all these caves? And they're hiding in the back. Now listen to what his men said. The men said, "This is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, 'I will give your enemy into your hands to deal with as you wish.'" The guys were like, "David, God promised that you're going to be the next king, and now is your chance. Go kill him. He's right there. God has set it up for you. God has given him to you. Sin. Kill the king. It's okay, because this is all part of God's promise." It says, "Then David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe," which we're not going to get into. You can go to the After God series and listen to that. But it's really wild, like how David uses this. But he cuts off a corner of his robe. Notice he didn't kill him. He didn't slash his throat. He didn't stab him in the back. He didn't do anything else to him. It says afterward, so this is the next verse. "Afterward, David was conscience stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. He said to his men, 'The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lay my hand on him, for he is the anointed of the Lord.'" With these words, David sharply rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. And Saul left the cave and went his way. And so David was like, no, it is not my job. God made the promise. I'm not going to kill the king. That's against the law. That's wrong. If God wants to get the king out of the way, God will get the king out of the way. But his men were like, no, it's cool. It's cool. This is the day that God's given you. Come on, it's all right. I know it's a little wrong, but remember the promise? And I'm not going to read the whole thing here, but jumping over to 2 Samuel 5, we see this moment where Saul is dead. He's killed in battle, not by David. And ultimately, the people come together of Israel, and they anoint David king over Israel. So he does become king on God's timetable in God's way. But his men were ready to justify it. And how often do we say, okay, God made this promise, and I know this is fudging things a little bit, but, you know, God promised to provide for me, so if I cheat on my taxes, that's God providing for me, right? It's cool. Like, what are the things that we're willing to justify? Because God promised. And we break the rules. And we disobey God. And David was unwilling to do that. And that's the challenge that we have. Are we willing to justify sin in an attempt to fulfill God's promise? Well, God said he's going to do this. So it's okay if I do that. And God said, be fruitful and multiply, right? So it's okay if I sleep around and get lots of people pregnant. That's cool. They were really mean. And, you know, God says that, you know, people shouldn't be mean. And so if I tear them down or beat them up or get them in trouble, whatever, then it's cool. The justification. And then finally, relying on our senses instead of believing God can lead to inaction. And I'll be quick on this one. But this is the story of Joshua, and we did a series. Actually, this story that we're looking at was in the unexpected series that we did, looking at things that don't quite make sense. But here's the deal. Joshua is now in charge. Moses is dead. He just died. You remember that story from a couple weeks back? Joshua is now in charge. They're outside. They're on the other side of the promised land. It is time to go in and take the land. They're camped on the east side of the Jordan River, and God comes to Joshua and says, now is the time. It's time to go in. You remember that promise? And again, I'm not going to get into all the stuff we talked about during the Stuck series. But he said, God says to Joshua, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and all the earth will go into the Jordan ahead of you. Now then, choose 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one from each tribe. So pick a guy from each tribe. And he says, as soon as the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, set foot in the Jordan, its waters flowing downstream will be cut off and stand up in a heap. So when the people broke camp across the Jordan, the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them. So what God said to Joshua is like, here's the deal. You're going to send the priests with the ark, which is kind of the most treasured possession that the Israelites have. And they're going to step. And as soon as they step in the Jordan River, then I'm going to stop the Jordan River. Now, Joshua knows, none of the other people do, except for Caleb, because the rest of them are dead now. But Joshua knows the story of the Red Sea. And in the story of the Red Sea, Moses raised his hands, and all night, we just talked about this, all night God pushed a great wind, and eventually the ground was open, and it was dry, and they're like, yeah, miracle! But God says, Joshua, we're doing things a little different. I'm making a promise, and my promise is that the waters are going to be stopped. They're going to be stopped upstream. You're not even going to know where it's going to happen. But your people are going to be able to walk across the Jordan. The problem is, this is a promise, but they had to act. And I don't know about you. Okay, can we give me a little sign? Can we start the trickle? Can we slow it down? Then maybe I'll act? Because God, can I fully trust your promise? But the interesting thing here is how the next verse starts. Now the Jordan River is at flood stage all during harvest. So now if you think about our rivers and creeks during flood stage and the torrents of brown, muddy water and all the crud that goes with it and how fast the waters are moving. It's not just like, oh yeah, it's fun. You guys can just dance into the water. You like my little dance there? He's like, no, it's at flood stage. And the way you're going to show your faith and your belief in my promise is by step. I'm not going to stop it before you step. And so it was part of the unexpected series because that's kind of an unexpected thing to do. And so it says, yet as soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarethan, while the water flowing down to the Sea of Rabbah, that is the Dead Sea, was completely cut off, so the people crossed over opposite Jericho. The priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stopped in the middle of the Jordan and stood on dry ground while all Israel passed by until the whole nation had completed the crossing on dry ground. God cares about the details. Talked about that a couple weeks ago. But it required action. And it required them to believe. You get that? Like, if they didn't step, that would never have happened. But they had to step and say, okay, God, if I step and you don't come through, we're done for, and so is the ark. But that's where we need to say, okay, my senses, my experience say, this is not a wise decision right now. My senses say, God, you need to show me something first. And God says, I've shown you so much. I need you to trust me. I need you to step. And if we are relying on our senses, it'll lead us to go, no, I'll wait until you stop the water. And who knows what it is that God wants to do and God has for you. And you're like, no, I'm going to wait. I'm going to wait till God shows up. But maybe if God made a promise, maybe you need to take the step of faith. And believe that God is going to come through. No matter what that is, trusting that God will come through. So even when it doesn't make sense, if we rely on our senses instead of believing God, it'll lead to manipulation like Abraham or justification like David saying, no, it's cool as men at least. Or inaction. If Joshua, they just said, no, we're going to wait. We're not going to move until God does something. Because all of these come back to it. God is always going to come through on his promises. God is always going to honor your obedience. And he's going to honor it in the best way and the best time. And to us, that might not seem like, I wanted it earlier. Can we not have the famine? No, I need to do it right now because I need to show that I am the God and Baal and Asherah are not. So our sense of hearing can miss what God is about to do. Let's pray. Father, thank you. Thank you that we can trust you and that you always come through on your promises. And not only always come through, but come through at the best time. Even though our experience, our feelings, our senses may seem like it's too late or not enough or not what's needed, but I thank you that we can trust you. And I pray that even as we consider the promises you have made, as we look at the promises you've made to us as your children, as your followers, and they are many, that you would allow us to not resort to manipulation or justification or inaction, but to actually just believe you and do what you called us to do. In that belief. Thank you for your great love for us and that you always want what's best for us. Help us to believe you, to trust you, and to act if we need to act, and to wait if we need to wait. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.